True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
At that meeting, he asked me if I knew of anybody who he could call on for help to take care of Susan. He didn't actually say kill her. I thought he meant just what he insinuated he meant, that he was going to try to get rid of Susan. And I told him, I don't know people like that. And it was the truth. I don't know people like that. Him. He's the only person I know that would do something like that. But this man is, he was extremely manipulative. He was a weasel. And he had this woman in the palm of his hand, this poor lady, that he bought her a pager, and the bills from the pager went to him, so her husband wouldn't know. And a cell phone, so that the bills went to him and her husband wouldn't know. And the night of the murder, they said she was trying to get back with her husband and they were trying to rebuild their relationship. And I hope that's true. But she called him from the church to tell him she was leaving. If she was leaving him for her husband, why would she do that? If her aim was to sever tie with him, why would she do that? Why would she still continue to see this man that she didn't want to be with? What hold did he have over her? Okay? I mean, it's just like people say to me, well, how did he manipulate her? This was a lady with a loving family. She was a church-going woman. How did he manipulate Susan? I can't answer it any more than I can actually say how he managed to manipulate me. I hate the thought that he did this to me. I hate the thought that I'm here. I hate the thought that she's dead because she didn't deserve to die. Who the hell was I to play God and decide this man showed me a picture of my son and said he could have him taken care of, which obviously he could because he got me to take care of his other dirty business. But who was this man to tell me that I can have your son or your stepdaughter taken care of? And who was I to play God and say, oh no, it ain't going to be my kid. It's going to be his mother. But I didn't have the right to make that decision, is what I'm trying to tell you. I did it because I was afraid, not for myself, but for my family members, because they were innocents. They didn't have anything to do with this man.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick.
Middle-aged mother of two, Susan Fassett, was an unlikely victim in a love triangle that ended in her murder. Married to a cop and a member of the church choir, Susan had a reputation as an honest, upstanding person. After her death, the secrets revealed about her life came as a shock to most. The biggest shock of all was that Susan was involved with a man commonly referred to as the scum of the earth. Fred Andros, a mean, homely, and amoral man, extorted money, frequented prostitutes, and somehow lured Susan into his web of corruption. Join us at the quiet end today for a story of corruption, sex, and murder, a secret life, the plot to kill Susan Fassett.
So we have a New York beer, although it's not from Poughkeepsie area. It is a New York beer. This is third anniversary Imperial IPA produced by Other Half Brewing in Brooklyn. It's an Imperial IPA, and it's kind of a New England-y IPA, so expect a lot of fruit. It's also 10% alcohol, which is on the high side for an IPA. So this beer is a cloudy gold color, small white head, a little bit of lace here and there. Lots going on in the aroma and the taste. We get some tangerine and peach kind of up front. Then some mango, some grapefruit, a little bit of pine at the end, and all of this kind of over a little caramel base. So it's a sweet beer, it's fruity, light, easy to drink, and you'd never know it was 10% alcohol.
Sounds delicious.
It is. But, you know, I'm partial to IPAs, and you like your IPAs too.
I do. I mean, I kind of have to be in the right mood for it, but when I am, I can really enjoy one. Yeah.
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay. Let's open it. All right, down here at the Quiet Inn, indoors today, because one thing we didn't really realize before we moved down here is that it can get quite windy.
That's an understatement, isn't it?
It's windy season, I guess.
And not only that, it can get windy enough that it kicks up dust storms.
Yeah.
So what we found yesterday when we were looking out in the height of this 50-mile-an-hour wind and dust is that the mountains behind our house disappeared in the haze. Quite unsettling.
Yeah, kind of neat, though.
Yeah.
I kind of enjoyed it.
Pool was a mess, wasn't it?
Yeah, but we won't be sitting outside today.
No, we won't.
No.
So, we'll be sitting inside drinking beer.
Mm-hmm. So, why don't you get us started on our story this week,
which is a
totally fascinating story, I have to say. I'd heard of it a while back, and then one of our listeners reminded us about it, and I really think it's quite a story. Worth talking about.
It is a very interesting story, and I'm amazed at the hold that this guy had on these women.
Absolutely crazy.
It is. So the Poughkeepsie, New York town assessor disappeared under very suspicious circumstances. His clothes and car were found by the Hudson River. When his body was found and fished out of the river, people had to wonder what the hell was going on in this normally peaceful town. But this is only the beginning of the story.
Sure was. Susan Fassett, mother of two, was shot to death as she was leaving church choir practice. Her husband, a police lieutenant, was the first suspect after it came to light that Susan had cheated on him. But this murder went much deeper than a jealous husband. Susan had actually been living a secret life. She had tried to extract herself from it, but she'd been unsuccessful thus far. Her murder was a murder for hire, and the price was dirt cheap.
Yeah, we know that husbands and wives sometimes grow apart. That's what happened to Susan and Jeff Fassett, and it's J-E-F.
One F, yep.
He always would get pissed off when people spelled it with two Fs.
I never understood that, because if that's the normal way, of course people are going to get it wrong.
Well, sure.
It's not something you should take offense at.
No, but he didn't like it.
Sure, but that's the least of Jeff's problems.
True. So the Fassetts had stopped saying I love you to each other. They didn't do things together anymore. And they didn't communicate. Susan was a child of the 50s, joined the peace and love hippie movements of the 60s and 70s. She was on the go from morning to night. Jeff just wanted to relax in front of the TV after a long shift with the police department. So 24-year Poughkeepsie Police Department veteran Lieutenant Jeff Fassett had confronted his wife Susan on September 19, 1999, about an affair he knew she was having with Fred Andros. This apparently was an affair that mostly everybody in their lives had known about for a while, except for the husband, of course. Susan was well known and was well liked. She had been the personnel director at the Poughkeepsie Town Hall for years.
Susan and Fred Andros met through their jobs, passing each other in the halls, and ultimately they started sneaking around having sexual encounters. Some people were shocked, but others knew that Fred was the kind of guy that would do that, and that he did have this strange hold over people. Susan's 20-year-old son Jason described his mom as the type of person who didn't want to say no to anyone. She was a people pleaser. She also tended to keep her problems to herself. The last thing that she would want to do was to bother people with her problems. So when she was having trouble in her marriage, Susan didn't tell anyone. She did have a good husband and she had two loving sons, but she and Jeff were going through a difficult time when Fred came into her life. And let's face it, Susan was probably a bit naive. Fred took advantage of the situation, and he was well known to take advantage of every situation that he could. What really shocked people was that Fred seemed to have a way with women. And if you look at a picture of the guy, that is shocking, because he was in no way a ladies' man, in his appearance or in his personality. But Fred had many affairs with different women. It was kind of mind-boggling. Fred was objectively ugly. He was foul-mouthed. He was dishonest. Just this crooked kind of mafia wannabe loser guy.
Yeah, I mean, besides his personality, just looking at him, I'm thinking, this is the kind of guy that probably has to pay for sex with hookers because he'd never get anybody to have sex with him.
Yeah.
But he had plenty.
He did, but that didn't mean he didn't go to hookers. He did that as well.
He did that too. Yeah.
He was also short. He wore heeled cowboy boots to get him up to 5'7". And he wore kind of outdated Western shirts and dirty jeans. He also smoked nonstop, so he smelled like stale cigarettes, which is really gross. Most that knew Fred at all saw him as a selfish and immoral person, and he was often angry. He always had to have control of everything. So the only person Fred truly loved was probably Fred. Everyone else in his life was just there to be used and abused by him. And Susan was a different person altogether.
She was. Susan Tabor Fassett grew up in Pawling, New York, on the Tabor farm that her father had inherited from his parents. The Tabors lived on a hill in a four-room farmhouse when Susan and her older sister Mary Ann were born. Eventually, the family built a larger house on the edge of the property. Now, Susan's parents had given their children an absolutely idyllic upbringing. Mrs. Tabor worked as a schoolteacher in the one-room schoolhouse. Her father worked farming the land. And they were definitely small-town people. Like her mother, Susan wanted to become a teacher. But her timing was off a little bit. When she finished high school, there were more teachers than there were jobs for them. At least so it seemed to Susan. So it seemed like every little girl wanted to be a teacher. The marketplace had become saturated. So Susan settled for an office job working for the town of Poughkeepsie. She didn't always feel appreciated there, but overall she seemed satisfied with her career choice.
So it had been for many months that Jeff suspected that Susan was cheating on him. But then in 1999, they had two sons and nearly 25 years of marriage between them, and he didn't want to believe that she was sleeping with another man. He wanted to be sure, too, before he confronted her. So he actually hooked up a tape recorder to their home telephone, and he recorded her conversations with Fred Andros. When he listened to the conversations, it was easy to tell that they were lovers. So for Jeff, as you can imagine, this is a disgusting realization that his wife had not only stepped out on him, but with this disgusting troll of an asshole guy. The next day, after he confronted her, was the day that they were going to celebrate their 24th wedding anniversary. But that night, Jeff took out his anger on Susan and he condemned her actions. He was unable to believe that she would actually have sex with Fred Andros, of all people. After things settled down, the anger and disappointment just turned into sadness. Susan and Jeff realized that their marriage could only be destroyed if they allowed it to be, and they decided to take control over their own future. So Susan walked into the bedroom that night where Jeff was sleeping without her, and in a whisper she asked him if they could please reconcile. She said she wanted to save the marriage. She was pretty religious, and she also wanted to repent for her sins. So she gave Jeff the pager and cell phone that she had been given by Fred Andros to communicate with him, and she told Jeff, "The affair is over." So Jeff still loved her, and he agreed to try.
So as a symbol of the rebirth of their marriage, they agreed to purchase new wedding rings for each other. And for the next few weeks, their relationship seemed to be back on track. Susan and Jeff were enjoying time with each other like they hadn't done in years. They were working hard to bring back their love for each other. But unfortunately, Susan had not completely ended her relationship with Fred Andros.
And Fred wasn't only having sex with Susan.
Oh, no. You know, he was hiring prostitutes almost on a daily basis. And he was also bringing in other women to have lesbian sex while he watched. And sometimes he participated, too, in threesomes with Susan and other women. He often organized these encounters on the floor of the town water department's pump station.
Isn't that just romantic?
I'm thinking, what could be a worse place? Well, there's probably worse places, but geez.
Well, he didn't want to spring for a hotel room.
Right.
Plus, you've got the whole funny name of the place, the pump station. It's pretty funny.
Well, in that regard, yes.
In that scenario, sure. And Fred also liked to videotape some of these sex sessions.
Yeah, again, I'm just amazed that he could get people to do this.
He had something. I don't know what. I guess he could manipulate.
I guess so, because he did. So one woman who Fred brought into his affair with Susan was Dawn Silvernail. Dawn was a 50-year-old woman, and she had known Fred Andros for years. And she felt indebted to him, because he often gave her small cash loans to help her cover the bills. And every time he'd do that, he said, "Don't worry about repaying it." Well, except for the time when he said, "Yes, you have to do this to repay me."
Well, but he wanted to use it to hold over her head.
Oh, of course.
Gave him control. Say what you will, he really wasn't stupid.
Well, I don't know about that. He was certainly conniving.
Yes, very conniving.
Now, Dawn had a low-paying job, and she pretty quickly became dependent on Fred for his financial assistance, as small as it might be.
But there really was more going on behind the scenes than Fred Andros' sexual escapades. There was a whole political corruption thing going on as well.
There sure was.
Town assessor Basil Rauchy had disappeared back on October 4th, 1997. Even before he vanished, he'd been living under a cloud. A few years earlier, he had been accused of manipulating assessments in a neighboring town where he'd worked. So he left that job without the charges being proven against him. Once he disappeared, the FBI was brought in. Later, it was revealed that federal officials had been investigating the Poughkeepsie town government after a complaint by a businessman. Prosecutors uncovered some systematic extortion. Rauchy, court documents alleged, was the money collector. And he disappeared the day after an FBI agent confronted him in a hotel and offered him a deal: cooperate or face prosecution. Divers scoured the river for days, but it was actually a passerby who found his body. His death was finally ruled a suicide, but many didn't believe that. Many believed that this was a murder.
Well, sure. I mean, here this guy's facing charges, federal charges. Something's going on. And the higher-ups in whatever organization he was in decided they needed to do away with him, right?
It could be that, or he could have just been depressed and at the end of his rope because of it and killed himself.
He could have, sure.
But in 1998, two town officials were convicted on corruption-related charges. William Paroli Sr. was GOP chairman for both the county and the town. Paroli quit as GOP boss, but held on to his $58,000 a year job as the county elections commissioner. Fred Andros, the head of the town's water department, suddenly resigned in May of 99. And the next day, he pleaded guilty to a federal count of conspiracy. He admitted to extorting bribes from contractors. Prosecutors said that Andros, like Rauchy, was working for Paroli. Andros admitted in federal court that he extorted money from contractors on behalf of Paroli.
Yeah, they had a nice little operation going, probably.
Well, until it all came crashing down.
Sure. So Dawn Silvernail met Fred Andros back in the 70s through CB radio chats. Remember those?
Vaguely. I remember seeing Smokey and the Bandit with my mom and dad, and it was a big thing then.
There you are.
Yep.
So Andros had paid Dawn $350 to participate in lesbian sex with Susan, as he filmed them on several occasions. In 1999, he began pressuring Dawn to kill Susan Fassett. Susan was the town personnel director, and Andros was convinced that Susan would destroy his deal that he had made with the FBI by testifying against him.
At least that's what he told Dawn.
Well, that's what he told her to get her to do his bidding.
Exactly. So first there was a plan to kill Susan outside of her jazzercise class. But that plan was dropped because the site was way too public. So it was decided that Susan would be shot outside of the Pleasant Valley Methodist Church, which was a white clapboard church where Susan went to choir practice. Her husband, Lieutenant Jeff Fassett, drove over to the jeweler during the afternoon of October 28th to pick up his new wedding ring, the one he and Susan decided to get in order to renew their commitment to one another. After that, he went to Susan's office at Town Hall so he could show her how it looked, and she seemed excited to see him. Jeff kissed her and told her he'd see her at home for dinner, and things kind of seemed like old times. But just before Jeff had come by, Susan had been on the phone with Fred Andros. It had been one of five calls between them that day, so she hadn't stopped communicating with him.
No, and it wasn't just that particular day. She'd continued to communicate with him.
Yeah, and we're not sure what they said to each other. But it could have been that he didn't want her to break up.
Yeah, that'd be the likely thing.
Could be. Or maybe he was blackmailing her because he had videotaped the lesbian sex. There's just no way to know without knowing what they said to one another.
Right. So around 6:30 that evening, Jeff and Susan were at home with their sons, eating a great dinner that Susan had cooked for her family. Afterwards, Susan was in a hurry. She wanted to get to choir practice, and it turns out that wherever she went, she was always a few minutes late. So at one point while they ate, Jeff was noticing what he would later describe as a shadowy figure lurking outside the house. Now, he was looking across the table at Susan when he saw someone walk by a large window. So Jeff decided to get up from the table and check it out. It turns out that it was Fred's hired gun, Dawn Silvernail, dressed all in black, making her way up the driveway and peeking into the windows, looking for Susan. To the kids and Susan, it seemed like nothing. Nobody was trying to break in or do anything. But Jeff was a cop, so his intuition told him that something was going on, something wasn't right. So just around the corner from the dinner table, there was a door leading to the deck, and that's the door that the family used to enter and exit the house. Jeff walked out and stood on the deck and looked into the darkness of the yard that was heavily shadowed by trees. It was a foggy night, and it was impossible to see more than 10 feet ahead. Susan and Jeff's son, Jason, was right behind his father. Susan walked over to the window in the living room to see what was going on outside, and then she went back to clearing the table and getting ready to leave.
Yeah, so outside, Jeff walked down their long driveway. There were only a few houses on the private road, so it wasn't uncommon for people to get lost looking for one of the secluded homes. So maybe this was just someone who was lost. But the weird thing was there was no car parked in the driveway. So the person would have had to park past the Facet mailbox on Route 44, the main road, which was a ways away. It wasn't usual that someone would pull over on the side of the road and get out of his or her car and walk up their driveway. So why wouldn't this person just pull into the driveway if they were lost? It just seemed like someone was being sneaky. Then this person seemed to notice Jeff walking through the yard, and the person turned and headed back away from them down the driveway. So Dawn said later, "In the distraught mental state I was in that night, there was something inside me that told me I couldn't do this now, not where Susan lived."
So aside from the person outside causing a little bit of discomfort, Jeff and Susan Facet felt like things were better than they had been in years. When Susan walked out the door and got into her car to head to choir practice, Dawn had already driven to the church. She was wearing a ski mask and was holding her .45 caliber handgun. As Susan drove away, Jeff went upstairs and changed his clothes. And then a few minutes later, he came back down the stairs and said he was going to the police station to pick up his paycheck.
Now, Susan was unusually tall for a woman. She was 6'1", and she was the tallest member of her church choir.
Yeah, the pictures we saw of her and her husband, she towered over him.
Yeah, she was long and lanky.
Yep.
But she's from a generation of women that wanted to be petite, so she would actually say that she was 5'9" or 5'10", try and act like she wasn't as tall as she was. But she really stood out from the others. She had this shortly cropped white blonde hair. She was very active at Pleasant Valley's United Methodist Church, organizing visits to shut-ins, and also teaching piano. Susan believed it was important to make time to help others, so she made that a priority in her life. It was really a part of who she was, not just because she was a Christian woman, but she was a wife, she was a mom, and just an overall caring human being. The church wasn't very far from Jeff and Susan's house. Various groups got together there, and that included Fred Andros' Model Airplane Club, which was a big thing with him. Flying model airplanes was one of his favorite things to do, and he invested quite a bit of time and money in that hobby. The parking lot there was small, so overflow parking was on a gravel area across the road. There was one street light in the middle of the yard. People who parked in the second lot had a short walk, but they had to walk across the road into the church. Choir practice was very popular on that night, and that was mostly because it was that time of the year. It was the fall, and the local churches were beginning to practice for the upcoming Christmas season. Church attendance goes up in the fall and the early winter. In church and choir practice, Susan could really get away from the stresses of her complicated life, and she seemed truly happy there. like a lot of people who sing and are in a choir. It was a very enjoyable thing for her.
It was a relaxing thing.
Yeah, and she could be around like-minded people.
Right.
So she seemed pretty happy.
She did. And choir practice was a big part of her life.
Yes, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a short break here for our sponsors.
Take coloring your hair to the next level with one of my favorite beauty products, and that is Madison Reed Hair Color. Now, for as long as I can remember, and I can remember pretty long ago, there were just two options for coloring my hair. There was the outdated at-home color, the kind of stuff you pick up at the grocery or the drugstore, or then there's the considerable financial and time investment of going to the salon. We're busy women, and you shouldn't have to be rich to have multi-tonal hair coloring. What makes Madison Reed Color unique is that it's crafted by master colorists who know how to blend the nuances of light, dark, cool, and warm to create over 45 gorgeous multi-tonal shades for us to choose from. You deserve a gorgeous professional hair color that's delivered right to your door and costs less than $25. Many Madison Reed clients have commented to me on how their new hair color has really improved their lives. It's a small thing, but it can make a big difference. And I count myself among these clients. Madison Reed covers my gray, even though there's only a little, and it's very game-changing color that I can maintain myself at home. And I look like I just came from the salon. I really thought I was chained to monthly salon visits for life, and I never thought I'd color my hair at home again. But Madison Reed has liberated me. My hair is really shiny and healthy, and I get this quality, nuanced color with the great convenience of home delivery. That's why I'm happy to recommend to you Madison Reed. You can join me in finding your perfect shade by going to madison-reed.com. True Crime Brewery listeners get 10% off plus free shipping on their first color kit just by using our code BREWERY. That's code BREWERY at madison-reed.com.
I'm just so excited by this company that I wanted to let our listeners know about them. It is Nativo Condiments and Seasonings, and they offer a variety of spice blends of Argentine heritage that I guarantee will jazz up your meals. I just used their heritage blend to make some seitan, and it brought a new depth of warmth and flavor to my tried and true seitan recipe.
It was good. It was a little different, but unique and nice.
It was. It was so great. I can't wait to try their other spice blends. And they also offer a recipe of the week, which gives specific food and blend recommendations. Go to ArgentineChef.com to explore and order. And for a limited time, enter coupon code NativoShipsFree for free shipping of orders over $10. That's ArgentineChef.com, NativoShipsFree. Try them. You're going to like them.
So back to our story. The parking lot that was connected to the church must have been full because Susan parked her brand new 2000 Jeep Cherokee across the street in the overflow lot. The 2000 Jeeps had just come out in September, and Susan was really thrilled when she bought hers. She'd hurried and made it to practice on time, so that was an unusual little victory for her that she wasn't late. Dawn Silvernail had never been arrested, and she never imagined that she was going to become a murderer in her life. But she felt that she had backed herself into a corner with Fred, and she needed to kill Susan Fassett. The only way Fred could be certain that Susan wouldn't ruin his deal with the FBI, he'd told her, was to have Susan killed, and he said that over and over. Now, Dawn wasn't completely innocent, of course. Her life as a wife and mother were only part of who she was. She was married, she had a child, and she lived what seemed like a normal life. From the outside, she appeared to have integrity and honor. But there was another side to her personality. A former friend would say that she was always well-behaved and never exhibited any tendencies toward violence to people or animals, and she often helped people. Another friend said that Dawn seemed to have respect for her fellow human beings, as well as genuine concern for others. So these weren't the characteristics of a killer.
Well, yes, but the other side of her. For Fred Andros, who had convinced Dawn to commit murder, she had performed sexual acts. Now, these had started years earlier. Fred would call Dawn at work, and she responded like some sort of sex slave. Fred would have friends waiting for her, who wanted to exchange sex for money. Fred paid her, and it seemed like she always needed money. And she'd even had sex with Susan Fassett for money. She'd had at least 5 lesbian encounters with Susan, all the time while Fred watched. Some he participated in and videotaped. Fred liked to stand behind the video camera and direct them. They'd meet at one of the water pumping stations he managed, or in the garage behind his house.
Well, isn't that romantic?
That's even better than the water pumping station, isn't it?
Well, remember, though, Fred had a wife, too. It's not like that he was a single guy.
No, it isn't. Now, sometimes Fred even wore a robe, like he was a Hugh Hefner type of guy.
Yeah.
Fred told Dawn that this was Susan's idea, that Susan had always wanted a threesome, and she'd always dreamed of making love to a woman. He satisfied her desire because he loved her, he said, and wanted to give her whatever she wanted. But in reality, Susan did it to please Fred. So Dawn knew that Susan wanted nothing to do with the lesbian sex, and she was only doing it to satisfy Fred's fantasies. Fred needed different sexual experiences to get an erection.
So any love that Fred might have had for Susan was gone by that night when Dawn sat parked outside of the church. "Blow her fucking head off," is what Fred had said to Dawn. He wanted Susan dead. Fred had shown Dawn photos of her family, threatening her son's life, as he talked about how he wanted Susan to be murdered as soon as possible. And Fred had it all planned out. He was going to take her car and change the license plates. This way she could pull in, shoot Susan, and leave without being identified. If someone saw her plates, it wouldn't matter. "I want her dead," Fred said that afternoon, very matter-of-factly. He felt slighted in some way by Susan, and he wanted her gone. And he explained where Susan could be found. Because they'd scoped out places. Fred had pressured Dawn by telling her that she would go down with him if the murder wasn't done soon. And Dawn remembered that she had been running envelopes for him, delivering cash to certain people. So she felt that that made her part of all of the corruption. She was already a conspirator. He had once told her a story about Susan getting ready to testify against him for bilking the town of Poughkeepsie out of tens of thousands of dollars, for threatening people, and also for harassing and extorting contractors. Dawn was certain that Susan was going to sit in front of a grand jury and implicate Fred any day now, and then he would in turn implicate Dawn. So if Dawn didn't complete the job now, it was going to be all over for both of them. Susan was going to provide evidence to put them both away for a long time.
Or so said Fred.
That's what Fred had told Dawn, so a little look into what was going on in Dawn's mind as she sat in this church, psyching herself up to do this horrible thing.
So things hadn't worked out as she planned back at Susan's house. Dawn had snuck around the yard, walked up the driveway, saw Jeff Fassett walking towards her, and decided to leave. Now, Fred had threatened Dawn's family again just the night before, October 27th. And that's why she was at Susan's church, determined to kill her when she exited the building. She left the Fassett home and pulled off to the side of the road and cried. She was terrified of what was about to happen.
Yeah, but for some stupid reason, why didn't she just go to the police and tell them what was going on? Or there's so many different things she could have done.
I know.
But I mean, you really can't feel too sorry for her, because she had many options.
She did, but none of them seemed viable to her.
According to her, at the time, yes.
So she pulled up across the street from the church, and she saw Susan's Jeep Cherokee parked in the church overflow parking lot. So she decided to park next to the Jeep. With the streetlight hanging over the Jeep, it lit up the area around the vehicle. Dawn waited for Susan to come out to her car after a choir practice. It was 8:30 p.m. Fred had told Dawn that Susan would come out somewhere around 8:30. Dawn had backed her car into a spot next to Susan's Jeep, and she slid over to the passenger seat and reclined the seat all the way back, so you could look in the car and not easily see her. And she was right next to Susan's driver's side door. So she loaded the gun and rolled down the window. She was in position. So she had the gun in her hand while she waited, with her arm stretched out by her side. And every minute or two, she would lift up her head to see if anyone was coming. Now, inside the church, Susan finished choir practice at 8:30, right on schedule, and she began packing up her things at about 8:35, ready to go home.
Yeah, there was the usual, when you finish something up, chit-chat amongst the people.
Oh, sure.
Church friend Madeline Kearns walked with Susan into the parking lot, and according to a police report, another one of Susan's friends was following behind them and caught up with them. They all stopped and chatted. Susan mentioned to Madeline and the other women that she had parked across the street, and Madeline had said something about seeing her on Sunday. The women then nodded to one another and smiled, and they parted ways. Susan walked across the street as Madeline was standing outside digging in her purse for her car keys. Susan's other friend walked toward her own vehicle and began climbing in. Dawn had on a ski mask and a pair of gloves by this time. She'd used a second pair of gloves earlier that day to wash each bullet before placing it in the clip. And both sets of gloves were going to be tossed out after the crime. She'd been waiting for about 20 minutes when she finally saw Susan. No one else was in that parking lot. Susan walked over to her Jeep and she was fidgeting inside her purse for her keys. Then she stepped into her Jeep after opening the door and never looked back at the car parked next to her. Susan might have been stressed over the affair, but she certainly wasn't thinking that someone was waiting to kill her. Sitting in the driver's seat, Susan started the Jeep, she turned on the headlights, and she grabbed for her seat belt. Madeline Kearns and the other woman who had walked out of the church with Susan were still in the parking lot across the street, standing outside of their vehicles. Once the Jeep started up, Dawn decided she had to act before Susan pulled away. So she sat up, facing Susan, pointed her gun, and pulled the trigger. The first shot broke the driver's side window on Susan's Jeep, and it hit her in the neck, ripping two major arteries.
Yeah, this was a fortuitous shot, in a sense. She blew out both carotid arteries that supply blood to the brain.
Yeah.
So you're going to bleed out and be dead pretty quickly.
Yes, that was a fatal shot. The first one was fatal.
Right. I mean, she had maybe a few seconds, but that was it.
Yeah, the shot had gone through the window, entered Susan's neck, and exited on the opposite side of her neck. Then it passed through the passenger side window and off into a wooded area near the lot. Susan had somehow managed to open her door, and she fell out of the Jeep onto the ground. That was when Dawn unloaded her gun with five more shots. The shells landed inside her car, on the seat, and on the floor. Susan's friend Madeline Kearns was still standing outside the church when she and another choir member heard firecracker sounds, as they described them, coming from across the street. There were six loud pops. Then when they realized the sounds weren't fireworks, Madeline looked toward the noise and saw a vehicle screeching out of the lot. She described the vehicle as a light-colored sedan or possibly a station wagon.
Well, that doesn't exactly describe it, does it?
It's not a great description.
Could be a car or could be a wagon. Susan is unconscious on the ground, so the upper half of her body is propped up against the Jeep. Forensics would later find a bullet lodged in the doorframe of the Jeep, so shots had been fired very quickly as Susan fell out of her vehicle, and Susan had four gunshot wounds to her body. Now it was dark out, the light hanging over Susan's car and several lights in the second lot were the only sources of light on the entire street. Susan was having a hard time breathing.
Well, of course.
She's fatally shot, yeah. She's moaning. She's incoherent and wheezing. Her lungs were filling up with blood. EMTs in the Dutchess County Sheriff's Office rushed toward the scene after church members and a local man who had heard the shots called 911.
Dawn peeled off her ski mask when she'd driven far enough away from the scene so that no one would see her. Fred had given her specific instructions to follow Martin Road toward Route 71, then back on Route 44, where she was told to drive 4 miles back to Poughkeepsie and stop at Van Wagner Road to dump everything she'd used to commit the murder in the woods there on the side of the road. As she came to an intersection looking both ways, a state trooper with lights flashing and sirens blaring past her, heading in the opposite direction toward the church. She knew he was going to the crime scene. She put the gun in a plastic garbage bag behind the tree where Fred had told her to leave it. And there was a short dirt shoulder off the road with several acres of woods off to the side. There was an old oak tree on its side which had fallen over near the beginning of a trail. And Fred had told her to put everything behind that dead tree. promising he would retrieve everything later that night. So Dawn left the bag where Fred told her to, and she drove to her sister's house, which was very nearby. Her sister wasn't home, so she drove to Hyde Park and stopped at a convenience store gas station out on Route 9G to use the payphone. She looked around the parking lot to make sure no one was watching, and then she pulled up to the payphone and she called Fred's pager number. When she heard it, she put in the number 666. This was the code to tell him that the murder was done. Fred Andros was at home when this page came in. He was working on his model planes with a friend of his, who was a cop.
Interesting, isn't it?
So that's kind of funny, in a strange, not funny way.
Well, I think that Fred liked to have cops that were friends of his.
He did.
He thought it provided maybe a little protection or some insulation.
Probably did, to a certain extent.
Yeah.
Or maybe it gave him a kick to just do things right under the nose of a cop.
That could be, too. So Jason Fassett's girlfriend, I remember Jason is the son of Jeff and Susan. She was sitting in the living room of Jeff and Susan's house when she heard an ambulance pass by down the road. She got up and looked. Then minutes later, Jeff Fassett walked through the door after driving over to the police department to pick up his check, his paycheck. So no one knew if Susan was alive or dead. She had been removed from the scene and was on her way to the hospital. She was in obviously bad shape, but was still breathing when she was taken from the scene. Forensics was called to the scene. Several choir members reported seeing a light-colored station wagon, possibly a Ford, racing from the scene after the shots had been fired. So we've narrowed it down a little to a station wagon now.
Right. And the Fassett family has no idea what's going on yet.
They have no clue.
But Susan was late coming home. So Jeff called the church more than once, but no one there would tell him what happened. They had actually been told by police not to say anything. Several troopers and investigators drove over to the Fassett house. Jeff was told about the shooting, and he wanted to go over to the hospital to be with her. But by this time, Susan was already dead.
Yeah, I'm not sure she was actually breathing when they picked her up.
It's hard to believe she would have been alive that long.
Both carotid arteries were gone. She was brain dead pretty quickly.
Yeah. Well, I mean, she could have been brain dead.
Yeah, I just think she was probably dead when they were transporting her.
Well, and sometimes witnesses imagine these things. I don't know if it's wishful thinking or if it's because the blood is still gurgling out. It's hard to say.
Renowned forensic pathologist Dr. Michael Baden, working for the state of New York at the time, had already been called in to do an autopsy and determine the cause of death. And obviously, Jeff needed to be questioned. Now, his weapon, issued by the Poughkeepsie Police Department, needed to be test-fired and checked. So, the car that had been described by witnesses closely matched Jeff's car. So, the Poughkeepsie SWAT team raced over to the Fassett home. Jeff was a suspect in his wife's murder. So, the SWAT team knew that Jeff was inside his house and that he had weapons in the house. So, there was a worry that if Jeff had actually murdered his wife, he might make a stand against the police.
Yeah, there were cops scattered all over the Fassett's property. In the yard, across the street, and in back of the house. They were dressed in black and they had rifles. Susan and Jeff's son Jason grabbed some marijuana that he had and exited the house. He thought he was being busted and he thought, wow, they're really kind of overreacting here. He knew a lot of these policemen. It made no sense to him that the cops would be staking out the house for such a small amount of pot. But Jason, his dad, his brother, and his girlfriend had no idea yet that Susan had been shot, or the reason why the Poughkeepsie PD were encircling the house. Jeff had been making calls trying to find out what was going on, but whoever he talked to wouldn't answer his questions. So, at some point, Jason looked outside toward the backyard, where there was a hill by the pool, and he saw more cops in SWAT gear moving down the hill as if they were preparing to take over the house. So Jeff called the police department again after Jason reported about the cops on the hill. "What's going on?" Jeff asked, but they wouldn't tell him. Then a hostage negotiator called the house, so this was pretty shocking. They told Jeff that they wanted everyone to come out of the house with their hands up. So Jeff walked out onto the porch first with his hands behind his head, turning on command and dropping to his knees. Then one by one, his son Jason, his son Christopher, and the girlfriend Sarah were ordered to exit the house as well. with hands on the back of their heads, while walking backward toward the cops who were pointing assault rifles at them. So after they were all out on the porch kneeling, several cops came up and handcuffed them and walked them to the middle of the dirt driveway. When they got them to the driveway, they made them lie down on the ground on their stomachs.
Now, to me, that sounds like a bit of an overreaction.
Oh, absolutely it does. It is.
But I'm trying to envision, you know, if they think he could possibly have been a suspect. I guess I can see where they'd want to be proceeding with caution, but I'm just not sure you need a SWAT team.
It does seem like a bit much. So it was about midnight by the time investigators learned through several interviews with the police officers that knew Jeff and Susan, that Susan had been having an affair with Fred Andros, who was the former Poughkeepsie water superintendent. And Fred had also signed a deal with the FBI to plead guilty in a corruption scheme involving other town officials. Now, Fred was the government's key witness. So with Susan's affair out in the open, that just kind of opened up all kinds of possible motives and potential suspects in her killing. So finally, detectives went to Fred's house. They knocked on his door around 4 o'clock in the morning, October 29th, and they actually spoke with Fred for a while. He had an alibi. He was with that cop, and he came across as pretty relaxed. So for the moment, at least, he had manipulated the police into believing he had nothing to do with this murder. But then the investigation took a turn on October 30th when Dr. Michael Baden released a portion of the autopsy results to investigators. Baden had found a specimen of semen in Susan's vagina that was no more than 24 to 48 hours old. So this is important because whoever had had sex with Susan last might have information on what's going on here.
Well, sure.
So Baden sent out the semen to be analyzed, but without getting DNA donations from possible suspects, the results were no good.
Now, Jeff had been questioned by the police for at least 15 hours. He knew that Susan had been having an affair with Fred Andros, and he also knew that it was possible that, although she told him it was over, the affair was still ongoing at the time of Susan's death. He was shaken by the fact that they had made his kids out to be criminals and bullied them while their mother was dead in the morgue, and Jeff believed that somehow Fred Andros was behind his wife's murder. So Jeff took a lie detector test. He admitted that he had known about his wife's affair with Fred Andros, and he had even taped her calls with Fred and confronted her with it. But they had been happy since, deciding to stay together and work on their marriage.
So Jeff was still a suspect, but investigators began to look into Fred Andros more as a serious suspect. Fred might look like an ugly troll, but he had a reputation as a ladies' man. He seemed upset about Susan's death, too, when he was interviewed. Police ended up interviewing Fred 19 times over the next 2 months, and they did catch him in several seemingly insignificant lies. He said he'd been married 3 times, when in fact he'd been married 4 times. He said he had 4 children, when he actually had 7 children. So that sounds like, to me, someone who just always lies, because that has nothing to do with the crime. Why is he lying about that?
He lies because he can do it.
Yeah, I think that's the kind of guy he was. Okay. So he did admit to having an affair with Susan, but he claimed that that had been over for a long time. He said that he hadn't been intimate with Susan for over 1.5 years. So that would mean the semen couldn't be his.
Right. He claimed that he couldn't be intimate with Susan because he's impotent. However, just after tailing him for a few days, police learned that Fred frequented prostitutes in the city pretty much on a daily basis. So the semen found in Susan's autopsy was tested. Jeff gave a DNA sample to the police, and the semen was not his. So now we want to get a DNA sample from Fred, and he refused to do it. Police were able to get Fred to drink from a water bottle that he had left behind with them, and they were able to get DNA from the bottle, and the DNA confirmed that it had been Fred Andros' semen inside of Susan Fassett.
Aha. So they caught him in another lie there.
Yeah, that's kind of an aha moment, isn't it?
Yeah, it really made him the lead suspect now, because well, Jeff's passed the lie detector. It wasn't his semen. So Fred's the lead suspect now. The FBI came in and interviewed Fred, but he still insisted that he did not kill Susan. But then, after a lot of interviewing, he said he thought that a lesbian had killed Susan. And then he gave them Don Silvernail's name. Also, he said he knew the type of gun that she had used to do it.
Now, it seems to me he's given up too much information here. If he's trying to implicate Dawn, why'd he say, I know the type of gun she did it with? Jeez.
Well, Andros said that Dawn and Susan had been involved in a lesbian love affair. Susan had broken up with Dawn, and Dawn was enraged. So Dawn killed Susan for that reason. So police went to Dawn Silvernail's house with a search warrant, and they told her that someone had been murdered at the nearby church parking lot, and they were just investigating everyone who owned a .45 caliber handgun. So Dawn cooperated, and she agreed to go to the station for an interview. She said that Susan and she were only friends and denied having anything to do with her killing. And she seemed pretty calm and collected. But then when police examined Dawn's gun, they found that the barrel of the gun had been altered so that there were no markings for police to test against the markings on the bullets that had killed Susan. So it had been tampered with.
Uh-huh.
So Dawn was brought in for questioning again in December. Dawn told police that she had not told them the whole story, which, duh, they knew that.
Yeah, no kidding.
She revealed she'd had a sexual relationship with Fred Andros, and Fred had paid her on 5 occasions to have sex with Susan while he watched. She said that he had taken control of her life. She and Fred had known each other for 20 years, and he'd used her to have sex with other men, as well as with Susan. Dawn said that the three of them had threesomes at the water treatment plant, and Andros had videotaped them. And then eventually, Dawn completely confessed, saying, I shot that poor woman. Now, Dawn didn't seem like someone who would commit cold-blooded murder to the police, and she also had no criminal record. She worked with disabled people, so this didn't seem in her character. But Dawn claimed the murder was all about Fred Andros. She said he was extremely manipulative, and he had lent her thousands of dollars over the years, so she owed him money. He had told her he would forgive her debt if she killed Susan, and she didn't want to do it. But then he threatened her family. He bragged about having mob connections, and she said that she believed that he would kill her son if she didn't go through with killing Susan. So Dawn was arrested for murder on December 28th. She agreed to help police get Fred Andros. Police went to the Andros house with a search warrant, but he wouldn't answer the door or the phone. Finally, his teenage son answered the door, and when they showed him the warrant, they were led into the house. Police walked through the house, calling Fred's name. They stopped at an attic door, which was just ajar a bit, and they heard a gunshot go off.
Yeah, it turns out that up in the attic, investigators found Fred lying face down with a gunshot wound to his face. He had shot himself beneath the chin, but the bullet had exited his face through the bridge of his nose between his eyes. He was still alive. So yeah, I mean, he just aimed it wrong.
I guess, but still, that's very unusual to survive that. And in the emergency room, nobody was really sure of his condition. But he had missed his brain, and in a few days he was awake and police could speak with him. He denied having anything to do with Susan's murder, but he was charged with first-degree murder.
Yeah, and his trial started a month later after his arrest. Dawn was the star witness against him. At the trial, Dawn stuck to her story that Fred had directed her to kill Susan. She claimed that Fred had videotaped the threesomes, but police were never able to find the tapes. And after a search of Dawn and Susan's phones and computers, police found no record of direct interactions between Dawn and Susan. The only connection between the two of them was Fred. Fred set up the sexual encounters and had directed them in detail.
Dawn testified that she and Andros had spent weeks planning Susan's murder. This was premeditated and very cold-blooded. Andros took the stand in his own defense, and he stuck to the story that Dawn had acted on her own. He denied that there was ever any threesome, but he said that he had really loved Susan and that he had had sex with Susan just 2 days before her murder. So he changed his story about that. He kind of had to.
He had to. It's his DNA inside her.
Exactly. So under cross-examination, he repeatedly said that he didn't remember or couldn't recall to almost any question. He was trying to use his head injury as an excuse, get a little sympathy, say he couldn't remember things just the right way, you know, he was trying to manipulate the jury like he'd manipulated everyone else in his life.
Well, sure.
And I feel really bad for his kids, because at least one of his daughters was very supportive of him.
Yeah, she was really in his corner.
She was, but after he finally died, she did admit that he was a bad guy.
Better late than never, right?
Yep.
So the prosecution revealed that Susan did not have a meeting with the FBI, as Andrus had told Dawn.
Yeah, because he kept saying, Susan's meeting with the FBI in a couple days. You have to kill her soon.
That's right, because I'm going to go down hard if she talks to the FBI.
And I'm taking you with me.
So his motive for killing Susan was not because she was going to talk to the FBI, but it was because Andrus was angry that Susan had broken up with him. She didn't want to be with him anymore, and he was pissed off. So he used the FBI story to convince Dawn to kill Susan. So the jury found Andrus guilty of second-degree murder and conspiracy to commit murder, and he was sentenced to 25 years to life. 2 years into his prison term, he had a heart attack, and he died. And he had never showed any remorse for what had happened.
But Dawn Silvernail does seem remorseful. We played some of her interview with Paula Zahn at the beginning of the episode. So she seems remorseful, but she does kind of put a lot of the blame on him, so I don't think she accepts as much blame as maybe she could. But Susan's son Jason has totally forgiven Dawn. He said that he really believes Dawn was used by Fred Andrus, much like his mother was used by Fred.
I suppose.
I mean, she was used and manipulated, but there has to be something wrong with you if you're going to go ahead and kill somebody, because there are always other options.
That's right.
So Dawn was given 18 years to life, reduced from 25 years to life because of her cooperation in getting Fred Andrus convicted.
Now, there's a Forensic Files episode on this case, and on the case with Paula Zahn, called A Murder in Pleasant Valley. And there's a book by M. William Phelps titled Deadly Secrets, which was very informative.
Yeah, there's a lot out there on this case because it is just such a strange sequence of events in this murder.
It really is. Again, I'm just amazed by how this guy could have so much control over women.
I know. Do you think a woman could ever do that? Or are men too superficial? Be manipulated by an ugly woman?
What do you mean men are too superficial?
I'm asking, are they? I'm not saying they are. But it seems like sometimes looks matter more to men than to women. I mean, it's not that unusual for an ugly guy to be able to get attention from women. But I think it's more unusual for an ugly woman to get attention from men.
Well, I suspect from a male point of view that it depends on what other attributes the ugly woman would have.
Sure. But the thing was that even his personality sucked.
Yeah. I mean, there wasn't anything you could see about old Fred that was good. He was a prick.
But someone like Hugh Hefner, who you mentioned earlier, he had a lot of women. And he certainly was not so easy on the eyes.
No, but he was easier than Fred.
Well, yes, he was.
And he was a lot wealthier than Fred.
Oh, well, there is the money thing, which Fred had money, though. So for Dawn, he was a wealthy guy.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
For Dawn, who got a few thousand dollars over time with him, sure.
But I'm going to challenge you to find a case where an ugly woman manipulates men to have sex and do things for her.
Okay.
And to commit murder for her.
All right.
That's your challenge if you choose to accept it.
I'm going to take that challenge.
Okay.
And I'm not going to even say ugly, necessarily. I'm just going to say less attractive.
Well, you have to have something to compare it to if you're going to say less attractive.
Well, we've seen Fred's picture.
Less attractive than Fred? I don't think there is a woman less attractive than Fred was.
Probably not. But he looked even worse in his mugshots after he shot himself.
A little bit. But it didn't make a big difference like it would with an average-looking person.
Maybe not. Okay.
Maybe it added a little character to his face, actually.
It could.
Yeah.
So just a quick reminder that we have lots of TCB merchandise available. If you click on Shop the Brewery on our website, tiegrabber.com, you can click on our TeePublic link to get your summer t-shirts and tanks with your choice of True Crime Brewery designs, colors, and sizes. They also have phone cases, hoodies, mugs, pillows, just about anything. You name it. It's worth a look.
Yes, I got the phone case recently, and I love it. It's sturdy, and of course I love it because it has our logo, and then people ask about it.
Yeah, it looks pretty cool.
But Tee Public has some good stuff. I mean, the t-shirts are nice and soft, and I think I mentioned before how I love the lightweight sweatshirt hoodie.
You did.
Because some of them are just way too bulky, especially this time of year. Our music for True Crime Brewery was written and produced by Tristan Capel. And just another reminder about Team Tie Grabber. Team Tie Grabber is a way for you to give support to the podcast and get yourself an extra episode each month. As soon as you join, you'll receive an email with login information and a link that allows you to add our members-only show to your podcast app. Then, of course, you'll have access to all of our past members-only episodes, in addition to the new ones that we record and release monthly. In March, we covered the case of Robert Reldan, a real charmer who was actually a real monster, a rapist and a murderer, who I believe was enabled by his good looks and the support of a wealthy family. This month, we just covered and released an Alaska case, our first one. This was the case of Lori Waterman. She was brutally murdered by two men who ended up being friends and lovers with her teenage daughter. The daughter, who was 16 or 17, had apparently told these guys that her mother was abusing her, and they said that's why they decided that murder was the only solution. So these guys were idiots. Still, the punishment, or the lack of punishment, that Rochelle Waterman received just really is outrageous, in my opinion.
Well, you came down pretty hard on her.
I did, and I thought about it and thought, really, should I have given her more of the benefit of the doubt?
And you still say no.
I say no, but I mean, in the podcast, we have you to kind of balance that out. If it was just a podcast of my opinion, it was a strong opinion.
That's for sure.
But it was a discussion between us, which I think was balanced out by you being a little more open-minded about it. We'll see what people think.
We will.
But, you know, sometimes I'm human. A certain case, a certain person just hits me the wrong way, and I have a strong opinion about it.
We've had several of those instances.
That happens, sure. Yeah. Doesn't mean I'm not open to other people's opinions, because I am. And another important thing about Team Tie Grabber is that Dick and I are going away for the next 2 weeks, so there's going to be 2 weeks without a regular episode from True Crime Brewery. So if you're the type of person who might miss us, it might be a good time to join Team Tie Grabber, so you have some episodes to fill that void. One more thing I'd like to mention. If you joined Team Tie Grabber at the $5 level, our snifters are on order, so I won't be shipping those out until the end of April. So I hope you can be patient. I apologize for that. I should have ordered them sooner, but we ran out quickly, and it's going to take a couple weeks to get them, plus we'll be out of town. So I'll definitely have them out by the end of April. And one more thing, if you have a few minutes to spare, we would greatly appreciate it if you could leave us a review on iTunes or wherever you listen. The more positive reviews, the more listeners we get. So I think we should probably move on to feedback now.
Okay, let's do feedback.
Okay.
Now, not to beg anyone or sounding desperate, but we would love to get more voicemails. And to leave a voicemail with comments or case suggestions, just click on Leave a Voicemail on our website, tiegrabber.com. That's on the right side of the page.
Yep, on the front page of our website. And if you don't want to do that, you can always record it on your phone and email it to us.
That's right.
Another way to do it.
Sure.
Or you can do the old-fashioned way and just send us an email or a social media message.
There's lots of ways to get a hold of us.
There's also the True Crime Brewery Fan Discussions group on Facebook, where a lot of people share suggestions and information about various crimes. All right, so stop pandering. Let's go with the feedback.
Okay, we got a couple of voicemails. The first one's from Kayla. Actually, Kayla left two voicemails. This is the most recent one. And she has comments and a case suggestion.
Hey, Dick and Jill. This is Kayla from Texas again. I just left y'all a voicemail, but God, I cannot quit listening to your podcast. So I just felt like in the middle of listening to your episode again on Drowley Ridge here, I need to leave another one. I just have a suggestion for a case. I'm highly interested in the Lyle and Eric Menendez case. I've seen the episode that Barbara Walters did for Investigation Discovery about it. I've seen other episodes about it. And I'd just be really interested to hear you guys' take on it. From the claims that they were molested by their father and that their father had homophobic tendencies and the abuse of their mother, I would be highly interested to see how you and Dick could take on the Menendez murders. Also, again, I just wanted to say that I love you guys. Like I said, for someone like me whose husband is away 48 to 72 hours at a time and I'm stuck at home with a 2-year-old doing my school and God, unfortunately, watching endless episodes on Disney Junior, I absolutely love your podcast. You guys are a breath of fresh air. And the only podcast I can think of that I enjoy more would be The Dream, which I know you guys advertise. And sounds like MLM, but okay, what you haven't advertised. But Jill, I really think you would like it because it does hit on those MLMs and pyramid schemes that you were talking about when you advertise The Dream as your sponsor. But I just wanted to give you that suggestion that maybe hit on the Menendez brothers, because I think that could be a really interesting episode, and I think there is a wealth of information that you guys could find on it. All right, love you guys. You have a wonderful week, and I hope that maybe you get the suggestion and that this episode is featured sometime in the future. All right, bye, y'all.
All right, thank you, Kayla. Kayla's from the South.
Sounds like, huh?
Yeah, yeah. But what a nice voicemail. Thanks a lot. We really appreciate it.
It is. And we've talked about the Menendez case. I know we're going to do that at some point.
Yeah, I think it was on our radar and we just kind of forgot about it. But yeah, it's definitely one I'd like to do. I'm fascinated by it. It seems like about a year ago, there was a new special out about it where they interviewed one of their wives that married one of them while they were in prison.
Yeah.
So totally. I think that's a great suggestion.
I think it'd be an excellent one to do.
Let's do it.
Okay. And Kayla, I got to tell you, there's more TV episodes besides Disney in your future.
Yeah.
Part of being a mom or a parent, right?
Yeah. The same things over and over.
Yep.
Yeah. It can be tough. And they didn't have podcasts when I had a 2-year-old, so
no,
at least she's got that.
You just made those up in your head.
That could explain a lot, sure.
It could. Okay, now we have another voicemail, and this is from Lynn, who has a case suggestion. And as you will quickly tell, Lynn is from Scotland. You know, I love the Scottish brogue. Is it a brogue? Irish brogue.
It's an accent.
I love the Scottish accent. I could listen to it all day.
And so, we had a little spike of that lately, so that's cool.
Yeah. So here's Lynn.
Hi, Dick and Jill. It's Lynn, and this voicemail is coming to you from the little town of Ayr in Scotland. I just want to start off by saying what a huge fan I am of the show. You're by far my favourite true crime podcasting duo. I'd like to share a case suggestion with you today. Of course, it's going to be a Scottish case. I would love to hear your take on the disappearance of mother of two, Arlene Fraser, from her home in Elgin on the 28th of April 1998, and her husband's subsequent arrest and conviction of nobody ever having been found. Now, what makes the case particularly interesting is that the case was tried twice, and the second trial was actually televised as part of a Channel 4 documentary called The Murder Trial. Now, this is only the second time in British history that a murder trial has ever been televised, so I think it adds a bit of extra detail to the case that you might find interesting. Anyway, I hope you like my suggestion, and I wish you all the best. Lots of love from Scotland. Bye.
Well, thank you, Lynn. Lots of love from the U.S.
Isn't that nice? So this is an interesting case. This woman just disappeared from her home 20 years ago. Her two kids went to school and she left or was taken somehow.
We don't know.
No, because no trace of her has ever been found. No body, no nothing. Now, her husband was convicted of her murder, which is upheld on appeal. And as Lynn said, there were two trials. The second was the subject of a television documentary, which won an award for the best single documentary at the 2014 British Academy Television Awards. So I just thought it's an interesting thing. I just always get into people that simply vanish and no trace has ever been found. That's something I think is pretty interesting.
Well, and I'm curious about how he was found guilty. There must be a lot going on there.
Yeah, and there's a couple co-conspirators, and it's interesting.
Okay.
So.
Well, let's watch the documentary because I love a good documentary.
Absolutely.
Okay. So now we have some emails, and the first one is from Michelle. Michelle has case suggestions. And Michelle writes, "Hello, love the podcast. It was awesome to find a podcast hosted by a medical professional. It's nice to hear people get the medical information right." And Michelle used to be a respiratory therapist, so she knows quite a bit. So she says that she actually has two cases. "I live in a small town in southeast Kansas. In the early mid-90s, we had a couple of grisly murders that actually had far-reaching consequences. I'm not sure either case is enough for a full-length episode, but could easily be presented together. The first is the murder of Carrie Williams by Gary Klapis. They were in nursing school together, and he began stalking her. He eventually sexually assaulted and killed her. I have lost track of whether he is or is not currently on death row. This case is significant because it resulted in anyone getting an education in healthcare-related field, RNRTPT, being fingerprinted and paying for a KBI background check. Klapis had a long and varied criminal history that he lied about when asked to check the box for any sort of criminal conviction. Other states may have been doing it before this murder, I'm not sure, but this case got us on the bandwagon. The other case is for the murder of Stephanie Schmidt. She was a college student who worked at a local restaurant with a man who had just gotten out of prison. The only problem is, no one told her that. So one night, she took a ride home with him. He took her out to the middle of nowhere where he raped and murdered her. At one point, he asked her to kill him. She couldn't do it, and that cost her her life. The parents of both girls worked to change aspects of the criminal justice system. I read something recently that Stephanie Schmidt's father said he was done trying, that the system is so corrupt and broken that it's hopeless." Wow, that's sad.
Mm-hmm.
"I'm paraphrasing. It was very disheartening. Just from his words, I could feel his fatigue, sadness, and hopelessness. So I hope you will consider my cases. I have no beer suggestions because I don't drink. Thank you for all of your hard work and your time and attention to my email." Well, thank you for writing to us, Michelle. Those are two interesting cases, and you really spelled it out nice and clearly.
Those are fascinating cases, and I looked them both up, and she's correct. There's not that much info on them, so maybe we could do them together. I don't know, but I think they're worth looking into a little bit more.
Okay. It just makes me so sad to think of that father giving up.
I know, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's really a stab in the heart, but you know, it's probably very realistic that you would feel that way. You know how frustrating it is to try and change the world? Man, that just... You can bang your head against the wall on so many issues, and it's very frustrating.
Yes, it can be.
Yeah, it certainly can.
And our final feedback is another email from Jennifer with a case suggestion. So Jennifer says, "A drug-addled toxicologist who worked for the San Diego Medical Examiner's Office poisoned her husband with fentanyl, which she stole from the ME's office, and staged it to look like a suicide." So that got me right from the beginning.
Yeah, why do they have fentanyl at the ME's office?
It was evidence.
Oh, got it. Okay.
"She was discovered to be having an affair with her supervisor, who fled to Australia before he was indicted as a co-conspirator."
Wow.
Jennifer says, "I'm amazed at this fascinating, awful tale that has not gained more traction in the true crime podcast world because there were two books and a handful of TV documentaries." And there are.
Really?
I mean, there's a ton of stuff on this.
So that's one we should cover this summer then.
I'm planning on it.
Great.
Yvonne's savings card is what did her in. Anyway, would love to hear you two dive into this one. Cheers.
Well, thanks, Jennifer. Well, you know, anything that has to do with a medical side like that always piques our interest.
Yeah, the toxicologist is a woman named Kristen Rossum, who had a bit of a troubled life. She went off to college, started drinking, smoking, trying drugs, got hooked on meth, got clean from meth, went back to school, successfully completed her degree, and got the toxicology job.
And that would seem like a story that would give you hope.
Right.
Right?
Wouldn't it?
Yeah.
except for one tiny little thing. She got married. That's good, I guess. She started using meth again. And very quickly after she got married, she started having an affair with her supervisor. So here she is, newly married, back on drugs, methamphetamines, and screwing her boss. Not so good.
And he was also into drugs?
Well, he was into her.
Yeah.
So that's an interesting tale, interesting story. I printed out a couple things that we can look at and start getting into some research.
Yeah, drug addiction is just such a horrible thing because it really changes who a person is. It can.
It sure can.
She might have been a perfectly decent person.
Well, especially meth.
That destroyed her brain, yeah.
That's a shitty drug.
It's a terrible one.
I guess there aren't any good ones in terms of addictions, but meth addicts are tough.
It's a tough thing, yeah. All right. Thank you, everyone, for your feedback, and thanks for listening to us today. And as I mentioned earlier, we will be taking 2 weeks off. It's the first time we've ever done that, taken 2 weeks off in a row. So I think I'll have withdrawals.
I will, too.
Yeah.
I'll miss our weekly sessions here.
We'll really miss it.
But we'll find a quiet end while we're on vacation.
To just drink.
Right.
Not to record. But we'll be back in May. We have some great cases set up for May. And in our travels, we're going to be doing some research, some conversations with people. So I think we'll be back better than ever in May. And we have a really good summer planned for True Crime Brewery.
We do.
Yes.
We're looking forward to it.
Excellent episodes coming up. So everybody take care. And we will see you in 3 weeks at the quiet end.
Got it.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.